books. And the book that we're discussing tonight is Places Women Make, and that's been written by Jane Jose. And she's on the stage with Megan Lloyd, who's going to interview her. And both of them are very well known in Adelaide. I think I've known them for 30 years. They were very young at the time. It's interesting, in Adelaide, everybody has connections, and you would have known Jane because at one stage she was actually involved in the media. She's involved particularly in Adelaide City Council politics, which is a pretty ugly place to be, I can tell you. And she was the Deputy Lord Mayor, who was instrumental in many of the reforms that occurred in the 90s. She subsequently moved to Sydney and has been involved in a lot of urban design issues, often in diverse cities, taking leadership roles. And most recently, she's been the CEO of Sydney Community Foundation. I've always admired Jane. I was pretty shocked, actually, this evening. I heard something else about her that she's probably forgotten. A young man told me that she rescued him and saved his life. David. A child floating in a swimming pool, unnoticed, and she dived in and saved his life. So I'm very impressed, Jane.
Absolutely.
It's an extraordinary thing.
No, he tells that story.
He said, "You must thank Jane. She saved my life."
Aww.
So, anyway, Megan has probably saved lots of lives as well.
I've been saved from drowning when I was about 18 months old.
Really?
Somebody did the same thing for me. Yes, down at Goolwa.
Well, there you are. Isn't that amazing?
Otherwise, I wouldn't be here.
The perils of South Australia.
Exactly.
Summer.
Megan was a journalist when I first met her, and she reported on the Adelaide City Council fearlessly, without favour and with honesty and integrity.
I don't know whether without favour, but
well,
anyway.
With great integrity. And she's been involved with News Corp and succeeded and thrived and was actually at some stage an editor.
Yes.
And has obviously had a successful career as a journalist, but now she is involved in various marketing and communication strategies and works in the private sector, running her own business.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to have a conversation about Jane's book, and then we'll stop for questions. So can I ask you to welcome Jane and Megan this evening?
Jane's going to start. I'm going to ask Jane to start by reading something, but I will say that we were thrilled when we walked in and saw that you were all sitting down, because we have actually done this once before and somebody fainted, and basically that was the end of the afternoon. So, so it's nice to see everyone actually sitting and not standing. But why don't you set the scene for us with your
book. I will. But first, I'd just like to thank the university for having me here today. It is my university as well. And this library was perhaps where I learned how to research, though I'm not sure how serious I was at that at 18, not as serious as I was when I prepared to write this book. I'd also like to acknowledge that we meet on the land of the Kaurna, and pay my respects to them and their elders. I'm very interested in place, so acknowledging place, I think is important, and for all of us, the places that we spend our time in are very, they give us our memories and they shape our lives. And in Adelaide, you can be very blessed with the public places that you enjoy, particularly this university in the park. So, Megan, it's great to be here, and it's particularly lovely to be interviewed by a journalist I've known for a long time, who has read the book, has done the research, has some very interesting questions that we'll explore. So, to begin, I'm going to read a little bit from the introduction of the book. The city is our living room. Up amongst the treetops of the old figs that circle the driveway of number 8 Burtley Place, Elizabeth Bay, I first became an apartment dweller. This mansard-roofed, textured brick building is a local landmark in Sydney's east, a flat in one of Australia's first high-rise apartment buildings, designed in 1934 by the architect Emil Soderson, was my first real experience of urban life. It was Sydney, but inside the building with its Art Deco flourish, it felt like Manhattan. Before that, like many baby boomer Australians, I'd lived in a house that had a garden. For me, it was in a quiet street in Adelaide. Elizabeth Bay and Potts Point, where I now live, is Sydney's mini Manhattan, not so quiet, yet maybe Australia's ideal urban village. Moving from a house and garden to live without my own backyard meant that the city, its street cafes and parks, and especially its harbourside parks, quickly became my outdoor living room, a retreat on Sunday morning with a book or the papers, and I still do that. I learned that the way public places are designed and what they offer us changes our mood and how we feel as we live every day. And more Australians, and indeed global citizens, and the millennials, will be living in apartments in the 21st century. Shared public places and the way they are created will be crucial to successful, enjoyable urban life.
Thank you. So if you haven't already read the book, that's a great beginning because it does actually give us a sense of place and of where Jane's life is in Sydney. There's a standout statement in the book. We know that when cities work for women, they work for everybody. What do you mean by that?
Well, when cities work for women, they're safe. There often is shade. There's seating. You can get around them pushing a pram. Usually they're delightful. They might have some public art. They might have interesting shops or a gallery. But certainly they have some fundamentals which are about comfort. And if they work for a woman, they'll work for someone who finds it difficult to walk or to get around. They just work better.
Just work better.
Yeah. So and that idea of women-friendly cities is now becoming a bit more mainstream in the design as a sort of motivator for the design brief of public places.
So you were talking about, I guess, the small things, and I mean, I'm going to jump around a little bit here because I think it's right, but my favourite passage, I know Jane's just read to us, but I'm going to ask her to read this passage that I've marked the pieces, because I think it actually is relevant to what you were just saying.
Yes, it is. And
I was going to say, there are some bolder observations and there are some more stronger statements and some wonderful examples given in this book. But to me, this is something that really resonated with me.
Women leaders understand that small improvements across cities, such as seats and shade in neighbourhoods and main streets, add up to a better daily life in the living room of the city for everyone, irrespective of their wealth or health. Working on the small things isn't an alternative to major precinct schemes, but the human impact when the detail is right, when the small things are right, makes them really count.
So it's the little things like sitting on a chair to make sure that it doesn't burn you, you know, a public seating, like Jane was just saying to us before, or making sure that you can't see the bins from a major public building, you know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Just this week, actually, I got an email from Clover Moore, the Lord Mayor of Sydney. Could I join in a protest at 8:30 a.m. on Monday morning? Because the new light rail, which she's been instrumental in having happened, but obviously the state government deliver it, is taking out a Port Jackson fig with a trunk that wide. Well, they've already taken some out on Anzac Parade. This was another one this Monday. Mm. And in a way, you could say the removal of a tree was a small thing. And, you know, ironically, I think I lost that Lord Mayoral election because I supported the changes that have now been made to North Terrace, and that was seen to be removing trees. Actually, it was re-knitting the spaces between the buildings. But small things matter, the detail
matters. So you also, it feels like you mount an argument that women often have to undo, unpick and restitch the less thoughtful work of men. Well, is that a fair observation?
That's perhaps a bit unfair, but I think you've taken it slightly out of context. What is really interesting, and part of, but she is a journalist, part of the reason why I wrote the book is that over the last 30 years, I've observed that generally we occupy a world designed by men. The buildings that we inhabit, the architects of those buildings, the design leader, the known name, the author, if you like, is a man. That's changing a little bit, and there are a few women architects who've designed houses. And I could give you statistics on where that is. It's 50-50 women graduate, only about 20 register, and about 2% build anything. So it's very, I'm not making it up, it's very small in terms of building our environment. But landscape architecture is really different. It's a profession that grew out of America. It sort of grew out of the idea in the 19th century that it was quite suitable for women to draw gardens and to plan gardens and to draw, because it wasn't the metropolis, it was gentler. And from that idea, landscape architecture became a profession. In Australia, not until I think it's 1948, but landscape architecture is still quite equally divided in a gender sense. And in the world, some of the leading landscape architects, many of them are women. Mm-hmm. And they're women who are brought in to look at, well, there's this group of buildings, but how do you make them, knit them together? How does the ground work? How does the space that we
the
really
human scale,
yeah,
the scale.
Human scale.
So you write early on that women are the uncelebrated urban heroines of our cities. I'm interested in when and how that thought evolved into an argument and then became a piece of research and then ultimately ended up being a book about 164 women, because that's how many there are in here, and all their stories. Like, what was the starting point? How did it become this from that thought?
It's a great question. I think actually growing up in Adelaide and graduating as I did from this university in 1976, there was the celebration of women getting the vote in the Western world. So, I mean, I didn't really have a consciousness that I was a woman and that that would make anything different. And at that time, there was a great sort of wave of feminism that you know, everything would be different by now, and that women could really participate and do whatever they wanted. I mean, my first job was as a young journalist when the ABC wanted women's voices on the news. So, and then that was when I was probably in my early 20s, a decade on, I was in the city council. I found out the other day I was the 8th woman to serve on council in 1989, and council began 1842. It's the oldest council in Australia. So I didn't realise it was rare that as a 34-year-old mother of kids, that it was rare to want to participate in civic life. I mean, I was motivated then because I really cared about the colonial heritage of Adelaide, which seemed to be quite a treasure and needed conserving. So I guess in some ways it sort of began right back then when I was seen as a sort of an oddity. And then in the intervening years, I worked for 8 years in really quite a leadership role in Hassell Architects and Urban Designers, Landscape Architects. I was the most senior woman in 95 there. Then when I moved to Sydney in the early 2000s, I was fortunate in a way to be appointed to the City of Sydney's committee that decided on policy and development over 50 million. There was Lucy Turnbull was the Lord Mayor at the time, so there were two women on that committee. But there were still, where were the women? And in the architecture I mean, the major architects who really design the spaces that we inhabit, it's just begun to change. That there are more, for the first time in the last 5 years probably, there are public places being designed by women architects, but it's a new idea. Houses, yes. Grand public buildings,
not so many. So did you start by collecting these stories of these women? I mean, you would have known, obviously, some of them. I mean, certainly the ones that from South Australia that are here were people that you knew. I mean, yeah. Jane's in the book. You know,
well, I began by
Mrs.
sort
Macquarie,
of
Lady Macquarie's, obviously. Yeah. You know, there's quite a bit on her. But did you start to sort of acquire these stories and then?
Well, I began by thinking about the question of how will our world be different, yeah, when all these young architects who are women have an equal role in the design of the world, and I mean the world, the cities that we occupy. And then I thought, we don't know because they haven't done it. And then I sort of began to think about, no, that's ridiculous. Women have contributed so much. What are the ways that they have? I think the most challenging thing about writing a book is how you structure that story. And Wakefield Press, Michael Bolland was a wonderful editor. There was a day that he said to me, is this a book about cities and how you live in them, or is it a book about women? And I said, it's a book about women and how they've influenced cities. And that led to me thinking thematically about all those ways and grouping the women.
So, I mean, from my perspective, I found it completely relevant and timely and extremely useful in, you know, educating me about so many of these women. But I also have said to you, it made me really angry reading this book. And I don't know if any of you had that same reaction who have also read it as well. But there are so many great stories in here. And it's like, have women been terrible at telling their own stories? Or, you know, is that part of it as well, of not having a voice? Is, you know, the same thing, they're not prone to boast and, you know.
Yeah, I think you know, one doesn't want to generalise too much, but I think women often care about getting things done. They care about the end game and the result. And, you know, in the case of historically, many architects have been in partnership, you know, with a wife who's an architect, and it's not her story, it's his story. The best one, yeah, well, Penelope Seidler and Harry is... You know, and Ruby Madigan and Cole Madigan, who designed the National Gallery, she was, I met her one, you know, she was a force. And Penelope Seidler, well, you can see how she's keeping Harry's legend alive if you watch the ABC this week. But also, I think women, it's important that we do tell our stories because it's our culture. And I mean, our stories and storytelling really are how we keep our history or tell it in a new way. If our stories are always told by men and our history, it changes the way we view things.
So Marion Marnie Griffin's story must be one of the saddest in the book.
Well, she was extraordinary. I mean, not only did she actually design many of the houses attributed to Frank Lloyd Wright, he was obviously a wonderful architect, but she did work in his studio. A handful of his women clients were also, you know, he had intimate relationships with them, and she designed the houses. He brought the work into the practice. There was a wonderful retrospective exhibition of Marion Marnie Griffin, and I cited in the book for Canberra's centenary in 2013. And that exhibition really acknowledged that Marion Marnie Griffin had drawn much of the work, had been involved really at every level, and had in fact got the competition entry into the mailbox on time so that they could win the competition. Yeah. And, you know, if you've lived with a lot of male architects, you can believe that story. or work with them. And her story's sad. You know, she's buried in a pauper's grave in Chicago. She's probably Australia's greatest woman architect. She's memorialised by an annual award to women as the Marion Marnie Griffin Award, which is great, but there's not even a statue of her publicly in Canberra.
Sad. It's terrible, absolutely. So there's two aspects in the book that I think directly relate to where we're sitting now, both being both Adelaide University but also North Terrace, the environment we're in. So let's start with North Terrace, which for a period of time I think dominated our lives. I certainly wrote a lot of words on it, and you probably spoke a lot of words about it. But you tell a very different story about North Terrace, one that few people are probably aware of, and I'm sort of, isn't that just typical of the whole theme of your book?
Well, it is in a way.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that that North Terrace is such a sort of central street, not just in Adelaide, but actually in Australia as a cultural boulevard, because, you know, having lived now out of Adelaide, the Adelaide Festival people come to, the art gallery is admired, you know, the university is respected as one of the great universities. So North Terrace kind of matters. It resonates beyond Adelaide. And when I was on the city council, it had got pretty sort of tired and down at heel, and yet it sort of held what are the historic sort of jewels, pearls, if you like, along a necklace of North Terrace. And I think it was Winnie Peltz who first, who most of you would remember as a journalist and in many roles, she decided to start a group called Treasures on the Terrace, which was to really bring these very separate institutions that had, in a way, quite closed walls, all fundraising against each other. I guess they still do that. But she brought this idea that North Terrace was special, but it actually needed to be recalibrated, if you like, for the late 20th century or the 21st century coming. I was on council, I moved. Design competitions were a sort of new idea for Adelaide. Move that we have a design competition and throw it open nationally, and there, that was held, and some great ideas came forward to sort of rethink it, and particularly to look at the way the buildings and institutions connected. The idea was taken up by Dame Roma Mitchell, who was living on North Terrace. At Government House, she became a vocal supporter of it. There was a winning scheme, and I ran for the Lord Mayoralty in 1995 and actually really lost that election over the idea that North Terrace and the senescent ash tree, some of the trees would be removed. I mean, you lose elections for a whole lot of reasons, but North Terrace was pretty central to it. And but as it happened, I then moved to an architectural practice. Jane Lomax Smith became Lord Mayor and decided that it was still important to look at North Terrace. And she and Diana Laidlaw, two women, and Janet Worth, Diana Laidlaw's advisor, really made it, and Jude Munro, I suppose, who, you know, there was a woman CEO in the town hall, kind of as women do. I mean, women have a tendency to sort of sit around the kitchen table, say, look, if we did this, we'd get this, and if we did that, we'd get that. Why don't we do this? And Jane could probably tell the story better than me, but essentially there was an alliance to make North Terrace a priority. And it was, I guess, the combination of the city and the state funding, you know, the new expansions to the institutions. So I guess I tell it in a different way, including having been here as a child for the Christmas pageant. Mm. You know, North Terrace is really such a ceremonial, such a critical front door.
And yet
for Adelaide.
So many buildings have their back to it, especially on that side of the road, don't they? The other aspect to North Terrace is obviously where uni is here, and it was the link that I'm making is the chapter on women's gifts, if you haven't read the book. And for me, that was really eye-opening because I don't know why, but maybe I've just feel that there was, we never quite had the same culture or history of philanthropy in this country that you see overseas, in particular, especially like countries like the US or a lot of Europe. But this was really eye-opening to me, reading this chapter about the extent of philanthropy, but the women that were behind a lot of the philanthropy. Yeah.
Well, when I began exploring that idea of what are the places that women have given us, I realised a lot of the places that I really loved to go to, women had given us. Mm. And places like the Maya Music Bowl, which is really, again, such an important place in Australia's social history, if you like, that was the idea of Dame Merlin Maya. I mean, women often...
But Sydney probably gets the credit. The husband.
Sorry, Dame... Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. It's called the Sydney Maya Music Bowl.
Yeah.
It's not called the Dame Maya Music Bowl. But it's such an important thing that she gave Melbourne the number of people who, without buying a ticket, could hear a symphony or an opera or, you know, for the first time. And when you delve a little bit, Dame Elizabeth Murdoch was endlessly generous to the State Library of South Australia. She funded the Melbourne Recital Hall. I write about Judith Nielsen, who, if any of you have been, given Australia the White Rabbit Gallery, which her preoccupation is really collecting contemporary Chinese art to try and make sense of China and our relationship to it. And she's made a public place and given that to the community. Equally, Jean Sherman, who had a contemporary art gallery and then turned it into a foundation as a place that people with ideas could meet, launch books, exhibit. I think...
Even locally, Ulrika Klein.
Yeah, Ulrika Klein, you know, remarkable philanthropist. And with most of those women, there's a story that they've really loved something and they've often engaged with it for themselves, like Ulrika Klein, who founded Jurlique, loves chamber music. She acquired the Guarneri instruments for the Australian String Quartet that this university has supported so marvellously for a long time. And then she's created a centre for musical performances so that young musicians... I mean, probably, if you haven't been, do go.
Definitely Nat Barker, isn't
it? Yeah, but even Carrick Hill, Ursula Hayward collected and loved that house. Quite an extraordinary thing to do, to bring that house from Britain to the foothills of the Adelaide Hills. And I think it had the first ensuite bathroom and shower. So, you know, she was a real innovator. Sunday Reed, equally at Heidi, and now Heidi is such a great public place. The Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, if you're ever in Boston, is another one. And I realise so many of the places that over 30 years I love visiting, house museums particularly, there's always a woman behind it. Mm. And as I've moved into philanthropy, running a community foundation and the Women's Fund, women are influential are influential in cities through philanthropy.
So you do mention some fabulous women, and as I've said, there are 164, if you care to count them.
I didn't count them, actually.
Yeah. So I guess I'm interested in who surprised you the most obviously some of them were probably like old favourites and friends and people that were contemporaries, but
the one I sort of feel I unearthed a bit, because I didn't really know much about her, was Diamantina Roma Bowen. Hands up, who's heard of her?
Been to Roma. Yes. Being alongside the Diamond Dean.
Well, she was an Aeolian princess.
Yes.
And amazing wife of story. The first governor of Brisbane. And Brisbane would have been pretty rough then when she arrived from the islands off Venice, where she grew up. And, of course, she was a sort of civilising influence in the beginning of Brisbane. And Roma Street State, there's a lot of places named after her, including hospitals and things. So it kind of interested me, you know, the women like Lady Jane Franklin too, who gave, she's on the cover actually, she gave Australia's first botanic garden because she was interested in trying to make sense of Australian native plants. So it wasn't actually a botanic garden in the sense that, that we have one here. And then people I admire, Jackie Kennedy, I think, was sort of pretty remarkable as a heritage advocate. I mean, she did so much in the US. She saved Grand Central Station from being demolished when she was a widow and about 34. And she just said, you know, wrote letters, stop the developers, stop it. Yeah. We need to keep this. She saved much of Washington's heritage, and she had restored the White House and actually had an atelier in the White House. She collected all the furniture that had been removed put it back. So, but she didn't have to do that. She had a perfectly easy life. You know, that would have been a big fight in New York to do that.
Absolutely. And I mean, and that's an aspect of her that's not really, doesn't come out a lot. People tend to focus on the love life or the fashion or the husband.
Yeah, the style.
Exactly.
Not the substance.
Exactly.
And
absolutely.
It was there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So obviously many of the women are historical that you write about, you know, even Jackie Kennedy. But so you interview some of your, I suppose we could call them contemporaries. I'm interested in your meeting with landscape architect Catherine Gustafson, because I know that that was interesting. I think you met her in Chicago. Did you actually go to Chicago to meet her?
No, I went to Chicago and saw her work.
Her work, yeah.
Yeah, and wanted to meet her.
And because she's also one of the women.
And then I did meet her.
She's one of the women, I think, that actually, or one of the people that you've interviewed that actually sort of answers one of your book's main questions. Would our cities be different if more women were their designers?
Yeah. Well, she's a North American landscape architect who has worked between Seattle and Paris. She designed the Diana Memorial in Hyde Park, and she designed Millennium Park in Chicago, which is really, well, it's a completely created place, and it's a very beautiful and very successful created place. I met her actually in Sydney because she was advising on Barangaroo, the big new development of office, monumental office towers. And she was really interesting to talk to about. She just said the glass ceiling on our, she wanted to be a designer and she wanted to build things. And the glass ceiling on architecture was just too hard. It just seemed that she would never be able to do that. But she talked a lot about her practice. She only employs women. She talked about, we discussed the issue, which is a really sensitive conversation about, is there a difference in design sensibility? Is there a female sensibility when it comes to the design and making of things? Are women more natural nurturers? And she was pretty direct. She said, she just leant in and said, yes, but men can have that too, and the best ones do. So she had four scotches, I think, while we were talking. she was quite forthright about how challenging it is, though. She says it's one thing to be able to design something, but building anything in a city is really hard to do.
Mm-hmm. So who surprised you when you've discovered this story? Is there someone that stands out?
No, I think I think the politician, the women who go into politics, the politics of the city, I think they, it's not so much that they surprise me, but I think it requires great courage, mm-hmm. actually, to say, no, re-look at something, mm-hmm. because in the making of cities, there's so much money, profit at stake. And it really is very difficult mm-hmm. to say, go back and do that again, mm-hmm. go back and look again. I mean, Jane will know exactly what I'm talking about, but one example, I mean, Clover Moore said to me, people have always said to her, oh, you'll never do that.
Yeah.
And so she'd say, well, watch me. Mm-hmm. And do it. There's a whole new precinct in Sydney around the University of Technology, Sydney and Central Station, which has parks and, you know, it's really come alive. And it would not have been like that apart from her. I think she said no to Australand, a major developer who eventually sold the precinct and said, oh, they just won't let me develop it. Mm-hmm. And then another developer, Fraser, came along, listened to the community, wanted to do it well, it's a great success. Lucy Turnbull stopped the pretty radical demolition of mm. Customs House, or the complete kind of gutting of Sydney's Customs House, which you'd have to say is a national treasure,
yeah.
because it's right on the foreshore where they landed.
Especially that rooftop bar.
In Circular, yeah. Well, yes, Cafe Sydney, yeah, yes,
yeah.
indeed.
Yeah.
But you know, the idea was that Sydney needed a concert hall and that would be a good site because it would be close to the Opera House. But she felt it would be better as a library. And she was behind. I mean, no, people don't know that because when I interviewed her, she said, how did you find that out? And I said, I just found it out. But, yeah, she made sure it was a library.
Mm-hmm.
And that... The concert hall was built as part of another development, Angel Place.
Yeah.
And part it was built as a deal done with the developer that you can have an extra 10 stories if you give us a concert hall. Beware what might happen on North Terrace.
Yeah. Did anyone not make the book? Ended up on the sort
of
cutting
room
floor?
Oh, yeah, no, there's a whole series of chapters. Yeah. There's actually a whole chapter about libraries Yes, it got sort of shaped. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are probably some.
That might be in
and
book two.
The books had more than one edition, which is a lovely thing.
Mm.
And I added, someone died, and I went to her memorial service, and I didn't know that she and Anne Summers had formed the first women's shelter in Glebe in the 70s. So I wrote that in because I thought. There's a chapter about women who started movements and there's a lot of interesting... They're the discovery stories, really, for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you mentioned the moral, needing the courage, and in Safe Hands, which is the first chapter, you do talk about the attributes that you think women need to succeed. And I just wonder if you expand a bit more on that, or if you sort of, as you went through the book, because that was like one of the early chapters, whether... you felt as you sort of continued on with it, there were other commonalities?
I don't think it's so much what you need to succeed as what you do bring. And you often bring quite a lot of common sense about mm-hmm. the practicalities of the small things.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I think courage and listening, you know, women... are used to sort of intervening in the squabble of family life often. Men can do that too. But, I think there are ways that we work.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly working with other women who are making, you know, policy decisions about cities, there's a particular frankness and directness. You don't talk around the issue. You say... here it is. What are we going to do about this? So I think there's, you know, I try not to say that directly, but to show it more through the interviews.
So is that a sort of a, not a formula, but a philosophy for us getting the cities that we need or want?
To be more like that.
Yes.
To listen.
Yes.
Yes.
How do we get the cities that we need otherwise?
One of the reasons I wrote the book is because I've got children in their 30s. They're living in apartments without much private space. I mean, Adelaide, it's probably still common that people have a back garden, but around the world that's changing. And so the shared places and the public places matter much more. I would say, and I do say in the book, our suburbs are broken. There's not a lot of quality, public shared space in the suburbs of Western Sydney or Elizabeth or... And you can't wait for governments to give you what you want. You have to actually, act. And so I was partly writing it for younger people to try and encourage them to think, well, you can either run for council or if that's too extreme, you can use social media, you can organise things. Mm-hmm. And that the other day in Sydney, there was a protest, 2,000 people on Saturday morning, young architects, many of them, because of the demolition of a building called Sirius, which is seen as a 20th century important building. Mm-hmm. So that it's a bit of a call to activism. It can work. Mm-hmm. Governments work against you at their peril.
Have you been to Bowdoin or Brompton, the new development?
Actually, I haven't walked around it. I saw it as a master plan. Yeah. It'd be interesting to go
to actually
and
see it.
See it. Yeah, how's it working?
Has anyone else been to see it at all? Yeah, I mean, there's some very small streets and some people who are living very close to each other. It's I sound really old if I say it's not my cup of tea, but it's not.
The landscape design's not
very expensive. No.
Well, and the question is, does Adelaide need to have that experiment because there isn't the same demand on land, so why would you do it?
I feel like the emphasis is on the tenancies and the hipsters that are moving in with the cool, the bread breaking and all of those sorts of things. And it's more about the retail aspect of it rather than the living aspect of it, like the focus on the public realm or the space that's there. It's more about who's inhabiting it rather than what it's actually giving
that'd
to you.
Be the economics.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess.
But that's also, I think, what media coverage of it tends to focus on as well. It's who's moving in there and what are they doing rather than how they're living, perhaps.
Yeah.
So you argue that women should be given a greater role in designing and influencing our public places. Can you perhaps expand a bit more on that? I mean, we've kind of been touching and circling it a bit as in this conversation, but...
Well, I guess really I'm arguing we need a more equal world.
Yeah.
After last week, this is certainly true. We still need to be saying this.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever your politics, really, women have still got a long way to go. And I think, I mean, Adelaide's now got Kirstine Mackay, a female government architect. Mm. I just think it's about diversity and different views that women see things differently and do things differently.
That's actually a point early on in the book. I know it's changed since you wrote the first book, but even in 2014, 15, there had been until then no government, no state architect had ever been, that position had ever been held by a woman.
No. And now Melbourne and Adelaide
have
culturally led the way on that.
About time, some would say. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's also, I guess, my preoccupation on younger people who are graduating in architecture. You know, there needs to be a conversation, and I'm pleased the book's been really well received by the architecture profession, who kind of welcome the fact that someone is actually stating the unsaid about the situation. And it is actually changing. There's quite a lot of conversation in the profession and the practices about how do we do this? We need to do it.
So is it just that the profession is one of the last to wake up, or is it that women are seizing the territory themselves? Or
I think it's it's a difficult it's a difficult profession. I mean, it's difficult dealing with developers. Mm-hmm. It's building a building might take, you know, certainly 5 years of your life. It's hard, but women can do it. Mm-hmm. There's a quote in the book Zaha Hadid, who it took 20 years before she was allowed to build anything in London because she was really blocked by the architectural establishment, who didn't see her as an architect, they saw her as a designer. And she is a designer, but she was a designer, but she's both. And she just said, I think I could design a skyscraper too. Mm. Mm-hmm. And I think there are many women who can and want the opportunity. So the book is sort of has put that out there. And I'm pleased that I've caused that little bit of trouble in the profession.
Absolutely. Shake it up. Yeah. I was going to ask Jane before when she finishes to read one more passage from the book, but we have got time for questions from the audience. So has anybody got? Yes, please.
Can you say a bit more about the interconnection in your thinking between the need for opening up the profession and the need to make more opportunities for women and the urgency of conservation? How do you link those two in your thinking and your argument?
Well, I think... No, thank you for the question. Women do take a long view, and it is in the profession. Women have chosen to be heritage architects and have often led the National Trust. The National Trust has a lot of architects who are women working in it. So there is a sort of link there, but again, that's also the gentler side of architecture, or it should be, conserving and researching significant heritage places. The bigger part of your question, I think, they say for younger women, if you can see it, you can be it. And it's quite a simple phrase, but in Australia, if you're a budding architect, the highest award in the profession is the gold medal the gold medal for a body of work and a contribution to architecture in Australia. And only two women have received that, and that happened after 2000, so recently. One of them was for her teaching contribution and her practice with her husband. The other one was for the Brisbane Contemporary Art Museum, mm-hmm. Kerry Clare and Lindsay Clare. So that was also with her husband. So a woman has never won that award. So I suppose if you talk about these things, there's more likelihood that the profession will pay attention and that the leaders in the profession will perhaps support women to have, and I think that is beginning to happen, to have the careers they
Does
should
the
have.
Profession need to be so deliberately restrictive in the
it's
way?
It's not that it's really restrictive. I mean, it's not deliberately restrictive.
But, I mean...
It's historic.
Yes, but in terms of becoming a registered architect, there is such a period of time between, you know, just doing an architecture degree doesn't make you a practicing architect, does it? You can't actually claim that.
I think you need that. You need all the rigor. It's a bit like being a surgeon. You don't want someone operating if they don't know what they're doing. I think you need that.
I'm not sure whether Sarah Paddock actually gets a Guernsey in the book, but I believe that Sarah Paddock is making a significant contribution. Sarah is particularly interested in women's prisons, and I think that commenced with her winning a scholarship which took her overseas to make a study of the design of women's prisons. And I've been interested to watch her career because her mother is a close friend. But you don't look as if you know anything about Sarah Paddock.
No, but I know a bit about women's prisons.
All right.
No, she's not in the book. And actually one of the challenges in finishing the book was that whole question of who's in and who's out, and there are so many others, and in the end you can't include everyone. But in my day job, let's say, Sydney Women's Fund has just done a paper for the New South Wales government, who's spending $3 billion on prisons in New South Wales, to suggest that they do them differently for women. So I understand, yeah, but it's a system designed for men that doesn't really work for women.
Do you find yourself like collecting names like this? Yeah. Like, we want to write that down now, I want to go and Google her and find out more about her.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm just going to stand over here so I can see you. A lot is made of Adelaide's cultural boulevard. And I'm a heritage guide for the University of Adelaide, so I take people around and they love it. But when you look over the other side, what do you see? That why can't we get some people, women architects or any architects, to do some development work to improve that? I mean, it's terrible.
And
there's two sides to every boulevard. You go down in the world, there are two sides. We've only got a one-sided boulevard.
I think there is a word for that, which isn't boulevard. No, you're absolutely right. That was to have followed. I think Jane Lomax-Smith can probably answer that question better than me. The other side of the road was part of the plan to come, but it hasn't happened. And I don't know how much urban design thought really the council gives to the city now, because I'm a bit out of touch. But I was surprised when Tiffany arrived. That was a bit of a shock, you know, as an addition to North Terrace.
So could I ask you just to close with the last reading?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
You know your spot.
No, I don't.
Well, Jane's getting her glasses on.
Are you going to start? I was going to say my favourite. I think it's appropriate, that last bit.
What page?
Oh. Yeah.
Ah, yes.
You got it.
Page.
Yep.
203.
Yep.
Yep. Australia's cities are still young. Each has its own sense of place and a personality that reaches back to the DNA of the founders. Australia's cities and suburbs are slowly becoming urban. Much work still needs to be done to repair the outer suburbs of cities. That will be the work of the next generation of urbanists. Changing our suburban centres will need skill, imagination, generosity, and especially the thinking of women to create the urban living rooms we now need. The women whose stories have been recounted here have shaped Australian cities in many ways. All have been passionate, some as activists who believe that getting involved would improve our cities and our living, working and playing spaces. On the whole, they've been well-educated and fearless, natural communicators, and happy to speak up when things seem off track. Rarely has their professional background been planning and architecture. It's just as likely to have been teaching, health, law, or journalism. Their greatest qualities are common sense and tenacity, the capacity for communication, and the possession of insight, compassion, humour, and most importantly, a female sensibility. Cities matter. They are alive and they change. They are the places we live our lives and make our memories. It takes commitment, imagination, to make even the smallest idea for change blossom from an idea into a park, a playground, a library, or a shaded street. With the influence of women, cities can be better places. Tomorrow's children need the places women make.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm so grateful for Jane, because she's opened up another place for us to get a little bit cross, and I'm with Megan.
Mm.
It does make you angry that women have been edited out for so long. We're familiar with the idea that scientists often had the lab technician do the work and that somebody else got the credit. And we know that in business this happens, but I don't think I'd ever realised or thought about this until Jane wrote this book. So thank you very much indeed for bringing this to our attention. I particularly want to thank Megan, actually, because isn't she a fabulous interview?
Yes. I thought there was a great presence from the audience. Thank you.